is the Coast 89.7 weekly news magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello, I'm Bobby Knock. On this week's show, not reoffering in this fall's election, Sydney Victoria MP Mark Eiking on his decision to call it quits. Sydney hosts the Scotties Tournament of Hearts, Curling Canada on what to expect at this week's National Women's Curling Championship at Centre 200. And blogger and political commentator Parker Dunham weighs in on the McNeill government's plan for health care in the regional municipality. Mark Eiking was first elected as the Member of Parliament for Sydney, Victoria in the fall of 2000. But after nearly 19 years as an MP, Eiking recently announced he's not reoffering in this fall's election. I spoke to him about his decision. Well, I want to start off by asking you what led to this decision.
Well, I think when I was home last Christmas with the family, and I started thinking about, you know, maybe doing some other things now and being spending more time with the family. We have six grandchildren now. So I was thinking, you know, and I wanted to follow some of my other passions, food and agriculture. And it's been a great 18 years, going on 19 years with representing the people in this area. We got a lot done together. And of course, I'm staying on until October. So we got a lot to do in the next few months. I'm in very close contact with the Prime Minister about some of the projects I want to finish in Cape Breton over the next little while, and it feels good.
Now, did the political climate in Cape Breton these days factor in to your decision in any way? There's a lot of anger at the Liberal government here about the changes it's proposing for health care. Did that factor in any way in your decision?
No, not at all. Whatever's happening in Ottawa or Halifax is no bearing on what I'm doing right now. There's lots of things happened over the last 18 years that didn't scare me away from politics. So, no, right now it's nothing to do with that. It's just a time of my life, and it's time to move on and let somebody else represent the area. And we feel very accomplished. We had a good run, and it's time to move on.
Well, let's go back to how it all started. How did you come to run as the Liberal candidate in Sydney, Victoria in the first place?
Well, it was 19 years ago. We were in the middle of harvesting, and I was approached by some people locally. I was just going to help out first. I liked what the Liberal Party was doing. I was not a card-carrying member, and so I was going to help out, and next thing they asked me to run, and my wife was very supportive of it. I was pleasantly surprised, I guess, that she was going to support me on this. And there were difficult years. We had the steel plant, the coal mine, and the fishery industry was in rough shape. And there was a big transition for me personally. But, it was 19 years ago. I left the tractor and I want to go back.
Okay, so you were actually out in the field and somebody...
Yes,
approach.
That's right.
It was harvest
cutting
time.
Broccoli. I was cutting broccoli with a crew, and that's when I was approached.
Well, I want to go back to one of the projects that kind of fell into your lap when you were first elected, the tar ponds cleanup. How did that come about?
Well, there was no doubt about Bobby. It was one of the biggest challenges I faced, and then also at that time, there was a very good group there led by Dan Fraser. They were working at the time, but they said they came when I got elected. They said, "Mr. Reagan, you got to get money for this to clean up." So when the numbers started being thrown around, and I had also a very good relationship with Premier John Hamm at that time, and between him and Paul Martin, and of course many of my colleagues, Roger and others, in the Nova Scotia caucus. We all worked hard together, but it was a big, big undertaking. And the other thing is when we had to do the full environmental assessment process, that was a big, big challenge for us to do that. But under Stéphane Dion, he was the minister. We got it done in 1 year. We got the assessment done. Oh, when you go there now and see the where the former site was, it's unbelievable with the recreation facilities, the new businesses that are up. It's I'm very proud of what we did there, and all the, especially the community who worked with me on this. Most of the projects I could never have accomplished in our community without that community spirit. There's no doubt about it. The Sydney of Peoria is a challenging riding because of the things I mentioned, but there's the resilience and the hardworking, and the people that step up to the plate to help me over the years was amazing. And whether it's community projects, individual situations, it's been quite the honor.
And the tar ponds thing started off. You asked Premier Hamm how much he was willing to contribute to the project, I believe. Is that correct?
Exactly, at that time. And because it was more of a provincial property, because it was a provincial steel plant, and because we also had federal government, we also had to clean up all our projects, because all the coal mining projects, Roger and I had to clean up all those.
So that's right, the DEPCO.
This was on top of that. So, at that time, Paul Martin said, well, can you approach Mr. Hamm and see how much they can come to the table with? And that time, Premier Hamm says we can only come up with 40%, which was a big number for a small province. That's $160 million. And then my colleagues stepped up to the plate with their 60%. And I think to have the environmental assessment done as quick as it was, to clean it up under budget, and to see what we had. Now, we had extra money left for some of the facilities. There was even extra money left after the cleanup to put towards dredging the harbor.
That's right.
It was a win-win-win, and I just got to commend the community for their patience and all the trucks that had to go in and out. And also, which was very unique with that project, we had a large component of First Nations involvement, where they had a big part of it. So it was a huge project. It's something that Cape Bretoners and Canadians should be really proud of.
So do you see that as a legacy of yours?
For sure, legacy of mine in the community, working with the community, but also Roger and other levels of government, of course, but it's definitely one there, and it's almost a model they're using for other cleanups and projects of this caliber across the country.
Now, you mentioned there are other things that you want to get done before the October election. One of them I was reading about is EI benefits for people who are sick.
Yes. It's always been I think when I got first elected, it was one of the first situations with individuals I seen coming to my door that was very, very upsetting, is when, especially mostly cancer, but it could be other ailments, when people came to our office and they were only getting 15 weeks of EI, and many of them were just starting their chemo or radiation at that time, and they were losing their vehicles and losing all their savings, and a lot of them, if they're lucky enough to get through the treatment, they lost their job. They couldn't get back in because they lost their transportation. So one of the things I've been pushing for is extending the EI benefits for somebody with a major illness. And especially nowadays, I think we need a more modern EI act there, because people are getting cured, whether it's breast cancer, prostate cancer, they're getting cured, they're getting through, and they're very productive citizens. And they paid into, many of them never drew EI. So I think we have to help them through that patch and get them right back in. I've talked to the Prime Minister about that. I put a motion in the House last week to put it in front of the committee to get the numbers and exactly what it would cost. Because, I'm pushing for 50 weeks, right?
But okay, yeah.
Most people won't use the whole 50 weeks, but I think it's a thing we have to do and we should be doing. There's no family that doesn't have somebody that doesn't have cancer or a major ailment. So we got to help them through it.
And what has the Prime Minister said about the?
Well, he thinks it's a good idea, but he wants us to get the numbers on. I mean, because is there enough money in the system to help fund this? Would we have to do we have to adjust the premiums for workers and employers? So I want to do the homework on it, and the committee's willing to take this on, and I'm going to be helping present this case. So we can move forward with it.
You mentioned the Sydney Library as well.
The library, we have a few. I have a few other projects around the rural areas. Internet and cell phone coverage is important in a lot of communities, and I still have there's still some improvements for the wharfs. Like for instance, I need to work on getting some money for Inganish Wharf, and there's a few others around that need some help. But in CBRM area, the wastewater is important. We're still going to help funding some of the wastewater. But I think as far as the infrastructure projects, the couple that come right into my mind right now is the Horizon Achievement Center and the library are two things that I'm going to be pushing strong for.
And looking for some federal money for both those projects?
Yes, and I'm going to be working with the other two levels of government, of course, the provincial and the municipal government to move it forward. So we have a good relationship with them. So we're just going to keep going at it.
So you're going to be busy right up until the next election, by the sound of things.
Right to the end, and that's what I like, being busy, getting it done, and I'll be able to focus on this, so which is good.
Any advice for anybody, for the person who succeeds you?
Well, I would suggest they sit down and talk to maybe Roger and I about how your life changes. I mean, everything from travel to if you have a family and how you're going to deal with that, if you have a previous job and how you're going to deal. So there's quite a bit to it that most people don't realize. Everything when you get up in Ottawa, dealing with committee work and different things like that. So I think you if you're interested, you definitely should have some supporters out there. But I think you just sit down and get the feel for exactly what the job is going to be and what's entailed. There's a lot of travel, whether it's to Ottawa or even within your own riding. The ridings are big, and there's a lot to it, but it's very rewarding. It's a good area to represent.
Speaking of Roger, he's going to be losing a roommate.
Well, or away.
Pardon me?
The truth is we haven't been living together for the last year.
Oh, I see.
The truth. So that's the... Anyway, you heard it first, Bobby.
Okay.
But we worked together and have lunch. But
okay, you're no longer sharing a place.
I don't know. There's a joke up there. We're staying together for the kids. But anyway, we don't physically share a place, but we sit beside each other. We still work on Cape Breton issues, that's for sure.
I wonder if your decision may influence Roger. I don't know.
And you have to ask him where his headspace is. But I've thought about this quite a bit the last few months, and so I figure now's the time to do it and be upfront and honest, especially with the people I represent and staff, and give somebody else a chance to step up to the plate.
Sydney is hosting Canada's top women's curling teams this week. The 2019 Scotties Tournament of Hearts is taking place at Centre 200. 16 teams and dedicated curling fans from across the country are in Cape Breton for the event. Dave DeVoe talked to Curling Canada spokesperson Al Cameron.
I guess start by telling me why Sydney was chosen for the Scotties.
Well, there's a reason that Sydney was chosen, and that comes down to just an amazing bid. They put together a terrific bid that made it a no-brainer for Curling Canada. And, when I say this is the world's most famous national women's curling championship, that's not an exaggeration. So it's a big feather in the cap for Sydney and Cape Breton to have won this right, but they earned it quite clearly. They've got a great facility, a great group of volunteers, great host committee, and we're excited to see what's going to be unfolding this week at Centre 200.
Could you say a little bit more about what makes bids competitive? What about the hosting facility and the hosting community would make something competitive?
Well, certainly, they put together a campaign of ticket deposits, and that certainly made us take notice, so that helps. But also, facility is crucial. Hotel space is crucial. The ability to put on a successful Heart Stop Lounge is crucial, and all of those factors kind of played into our decision. plus the fact that I think there was a genuine appetite to hold a national curling championship. This is by far the biggest curling event that will have ever been staged in Cape Breton. So that's an exciting thing from our perspective. We kind of experienced that last season by putting the World Women's Curling Championship into a market that hadn't hosted a major championship, and that was in North Bay, Ontario. And the place went bonkers. And, you know, we've been very, very excited to see what Sydney can do in the same vein.
Now, about the lounge, can you talk a little bit about that for those who might not know how it works?
Well, the Heartstop Lounge is quite frankly, I mean, lounge, I'm putting air quotes around lounge when I say that, let's be honest. It's a party over at the Joan Harris Cruise Pavilion, and there's going to be live music, entertainment, games, refreshments, food for the whole family, right? And a chance to interact with curling fans from across Canada. And the players will be in there as well for the up-close and personal sessions where, you know, our MC, Stu Brown, will be asking questions of all those teams, and fans can ask questions to them too, and that's where the autograph sessions will take place as well. So just a little bit of everything that will, you know, just is a great value added that goes on top of being the best women's curling championship in the world.
You mentioned fans, and I mean, it's obvious enough that women from across the country are coming here to play. What order of magnitude of fans usually come to this tournament when you've held it elsewhere?
Well, it's one of those things where, you know, I've been involved with curling Canada now for 6 years going to this event, but prior to that, I was a journalist covering curling, and so I've been to, you know, 10 or 12 or 15 Scotties Tournament of Hearts over the years, and I see the same fans at each one. They just adore this event, and they're loyal and passionate and faithful. So there's fans that travel from coast to coast to come to this event because it is so special and so meaningful. So, you know, there's a lot of friendly faces, familiar faces that we'll be seeing, but there will be a lot of new faces, too, that come and watch these athletes in action. So that's what's kind of great about it. And everybody's kind of the same mindset, right? They're there to watch this great curling competition, but they're also there for the social aspect of it as well.
And you see it throughout the age demographics, like you're seeing young people, older people, middle age, everybody.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's we're finding that, you know, there's a traditional curling demographic that we all know about, but we're also finding we're getting a lot of reach out into the younger age groups, too, because, they recognize how important a curling athletic event this is, and B, who doesn't like a good party, right?
Right, right. Well, we in Cape Breton wouldn't have a reputation for that, would we?
No, that's what I'm led to believe, that, you know, it'll be very tame, very reserved. Said nobody ever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, nonetheless, I suspect you'll have a good time here. So say a little bit more about the entertainment that's going to be happening at the Joan Harris Cruise Pavilion.
So, yeah, we've got a variety of great groups that we've booked, and, you know, we kind of relied on the local host committee to give us a heads up in terms of some of the entertainment that we should be on there. But I know it's the who's who of entertainment out there in Cape Breton. I mean, Slow Coaster, Pretty Archie, Carmen Townsend, Slow Coaster, and lots to look forward to. On the opening and closing weekends, we've got the Spirit of the Fiddle Kitchen Party, and that's going to be a great time. Aaron C. Lewis, Kimberly Fraser, Lawrence Martel, Buddy McDonald, Hilda Chason. You can look forward to that. That's going to be on the closing Saturday as well, February 23rd, starting at 10:30 p.m. after the late draw. So I imagine it's going to be jumping in there. It's going to be a real good time.
So that sort of goes with something you mentioned before, with a lot of hotel bookings and business coming from this. It must be quite a logistical effort to get all these bookings and things done. You know, a large team working on this year-round, or at least, you know, somewhat long-term. Would that be correct?
That's correct. Yeah, we, you know, so it's not our first rodeo, obviously. We've done this before in terms of with the Scotties Tournament of Hearts, but so we've kind of got a system in place in terms of how we go about booking hotels, booking space, booking bands and whatnot. But we've got a local committee that works with us there, plus the local event staff headed by Jennifer McCandy, the event manager. And they've been working very, very hard to get the entire community embracing this event. And that's a big reason. You know, the fact is that the Scotties Tournament of Hearts, not only is it a great curling event, but there's a reason communities across Canada line up to host it. You touched on it. The hotel bookings, the restaurants, souvenirs, all that stuff. That's money that goes straight into Sydney, goes straight into Cape Breton. Somewhere between $6 and $9 million of economic impact will be left in Sydney as a result of hosting the 2019 Scotties.
Is that the typical economic impact you've gotten elsewhere when the tournament has been held?
Yeah, that's an average. I mean, Penticton last year, the 2018 Scotties, $6.7 million economic impact. And there's a range. 6 to 9 is typically the range that Canadian Sport Tourism Alliance has assigned to the Scotties tournament parts. Yeah.
Okay. So I know people that are playing in the tournament are off to Denmark, I believe, for the Worlds, those that win.
The winner.
The winner. So say a little bit about how the winner will be determined for someone that's unfamiliar with the specifics like me. Is it a round-robin sort of thing?
There are 16 teams competing. They're split into two pools of 8 at the beginning of the week. The top 4 teams from each pool, roughly around Wednesday, will advance to the championship pool. And they play 4 more round-robin games. From there, that'll be whittled down to 4 playoff teams. And from there, we'll get down to the gold medal game on the closing Sunday at 6 p.m. Atlantic time. And the winner of that team will go to Denmark as Team Canada and will return to the 2020 Scotties in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan as the defending champion Team Canada team. So, and a reminder, by the way, one of the great things about this event, of course, is it's broadcast start to finish on TSN. And that means amazing exposure for the community. And it's great when curling events, if you've got fans in the seats, it just makes it look great. So I really strongly urge you, if you've got a chance to get down to Centre 200, show the rest of the country what Sydney's all about, right? Get in those seats and show off a full house and show that you're having a good time.
Is there anything else you'd like to add, Al?
No, the ticket details are all on the event website. So curling.ca/2019Scotties. You can find all the ticket information. You can find all the information about the teams competing, the entertainment schedule, everything you want to know about the 2019 Scotties Tournament Hearts at curling.ca/2019Scotties.
Actually, now that you bring up the ticket sales, there's been reports recently that the ticket sales have been a bit underwhelming. Does that worry your organization at all, or?
Well, that was done. That report was done before the teams were known. So I'm not sure if it's a valid report anymore, because that's typically what happens when the teams are announced, which didn't happen until last week. That's when fans start buying the tickets, when they know which teams are playing when. So that's not out of line from what we've seen in the past.
Okay. So, and actually, while I have you here, what level of attendance do you usually expect at these events in terms of numbers?
Put it this way, we're not satisfied unless it's a sellout.
Okay. And it is consistently a sellout, is it?
Not necessarily, no. But we're always striving for that.
Planned closure of the hospitals in North Sydney and New Waterford has generated controversy since the Liberal government first announced the move in June. It's part of what the province is calling a redevelopment plan for hospitals in the regional municipality. Local blogger and political commentator Parker Dunham is in favor of the move. However, he still reserves some criticism for the McNeill government. Dave DeVoe spoke to Dunham.
There are a lot of overlapping issues here. There's the question of, is there or is there not a crisis owing to a shortage of family doctors? There's the question of whether healthcare should be organized in a single health board that covers the whole province. And there's the question of how emergency healthcare should be organized in industrial Cape Breton. So to take the last one first, I think it's untenable to try to maintain 4 24-hour emergency rooms in a municipality with roughly 92,000 people. 3 different governments from 3 different parties have tried to do it over the last decade or two, and all have failed. we are at a point now where emergency room closures have reached a ludicrous extreme. The Northside General Emergency Room was open only 25% of the time last year, and the New Waterford Emergency Room was open barely half the time. We just aren't a very big municipality, and we don't need four 24-hour emergency rooms. And by trying to keep four of them open, we scattered the services in a way that they perform worse than they would if they were consolidated. Glace Bay has the most modern of the four hospitals. It makes sense to keep one there. Obviously, it makes sense to keep one at the regional, but I don't think there's any rational basis for keeping open the emergency rooms in the North Side and in New Waterford. Yes, it's convenient for people, but it's not convenient for people when they're closed half the time. So we may as well bite the bullet and consolidate them. I think that's a reasonable thing to do. And the framework around which they've planned this, and it's a very high-level plan, and lots of devils may be found in the details, but generally speaking, they're planning to open 50 new long-term care beds. That'll be a big help in healthcare in industrial Cape Breton. And they're planning to convert those two hospitals, or actually to close those two hospitals and in their places create collaborative care centers, which, the experience around the province has been pretty good with those centers. So altogether, I think it's a very rational, reasonable plan. And I think the government ought to be more proactive in speaking up for the plan.
Okay, so you seem to be suggesting that maybe there's a supply issue here, that there's just not enough doctors to keep the four emergency rooms open. Is that what you're saying, just to clarify?
Yeah, it's certainly true that the immediate cause of the closure of these centers is that they don't have doctors to staff them. But contrary to popular belief, it's not true that Cape Breton has an exceptionally bad doctor shortage. In fact, of all the regions of the province, we have, if not the lowest, among the lowest percentage of people who would like to have a family doctor and don't have one. Right now, it's 2.6% of the population of industrial Cape Breton is unable to find a family doctor. That's not a great situation, but it's far better than the situation in Halifax or particularly Western Nova Scotia. So I don't think we're short of doctors particularly. We're simply short of enough doctors to keep four emergency rooms going around the clock.
You said there's not as much of a shortage as perhaps some people may think in family medicine, but I think you've also acknowledged that there are shortages in emergency medicine, and I think that makes up a bulk of...
No, the shortage is your term. I don't see it as a shortage. The fact that we can't staff four, what if we had eight hospitals with emergency? What if we had 40 hospitals with emergency rooms, and if we couldn't staff them, would that mean we had a shortage? No, it means we have too many hospitals. We have too many hospitals in industrial Cape Breton.
By itself, it wouldn't mean there's a shortage. I mean, you'd have to ask deeper questions about whether or not there's a shortage there. The number of hospitals by itself doesn't indicate a shortage or lack thereof. I guess what I'm trying to get out of you is why do you think it's a matter of not being a shortage? There are critics. Like, what do you say to those critics who might say, look, part of the problem is that we're not investing enough money to recruit emergency physicians, and that's the problem, not the actual bricks and mortar?
I guess where we're talking across purposes here is you look at the fact that we can't stock four and say that's a shortage. I look at the fact that we can't keep four going and say maybe we should keep two going properly rather than four going in a half-assed way. we're assuming a standard that's unnecessary. And, you know, a generation ago, we had the same fight about whether each of these communities should have two hospitals. There were people who passionately, fervently, in fact, right in Glace Bay, the last town in Nova Scotia to lose its denominational hospitals, one Protestant and one Catholic. There was a huge fight about losing those. And now Glace Bay has one of the most modern, up-to-date hospitals in the province. That's because service was rationalized to have to put to concentrate our efforts on one good hospital in Glace Bay rather than two mediocre hospitals. We spend close to half the provincial budget. A huge portion of our revenue goes to health care. And there, you know, we live in a real world with rational constraints, and in particular with revenue constraints. And so it's not sensible to just operate with no connection to the reality of funding, the reality of what funding sources are available. Sure, if we had an unlimited pot of money, we could have a hospital in Florence and Bradour and Birch Grove, and you know, if money was no object, we could theoretically do that. The question is, what makes rational sense for a community of 92,000 people? Halifax, you know, Metro Halifax has two general hospitals. Industrial Cape Breton has four. Why do we need four in Cape Breton when Halifax gets by with the Dartmouth General and the QE2?
Some people might cite different demographics. You know, I mean, we're clearly a very aging demographic in Cape Breton, even by Atlantic Canadian standards, are we not?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why 50 additional long-term care beds seems like a really good investment to me. But keeping open aging, decrepit facilities in New Waterford, and at least in half the case at the Northside General, I mean, I know there's an argument that they shouldn't be too quick to close the new part of the Northside General, that there are some worthwhile facilities there. I don't know the rights and wrongs of that argument, but I'm sure that if you look, there'd be more geriatric patients in Halifax than there would be. Halifax has five times the population of industrial Cape Breton.
Proportional terms, though.
In proportional terms, it has five times, not proportionally. There aren't more senior citizens in Cape Breton than there are in Halifax. There may be a higher percentage of our population, but that still doesn't justify four hospitals for 92,000 when two hospitals suffices for almost 500,000, or certainly 400,000 in Halifax.
So how can the government sell that message? I know you've been critical of how they've been doing it. What have they done wrong?
First of all, the Premier's whole demeanor on all this is very peevish and very impatient, and not, you know, he makes no attempt to show any empathy for people who are concerned about their access to quality health care. When the issue has persisted, he's taken extraordinary steps in the legislature to change time-honored rules that enable the opposition to have a modest role in setting the terms of debate. For example, he has limited, or his party has limited, his caucus has limited, the topics that can be considered by the Public Accounts Committee to matters that the Auditor General has considered. And even then, he's narrowed the scope within that. That's never been the case. I would say, if anything, we should be going in the opposite direction, and the opposition should chair that committee, and the opposition should decide what they're going to look at. the Public Accounts Committee is not a place that's intended to be a rubber stamp for the government. It's intended to be a place where the financial propriety of the government is probed and tested and challenged. And that's a good function of the legislature. I would say at the same time that I object to what the Premier's doing, I really object to what the NDP is doing and what Tammy Martin in particular is doing. Tammy Martin is pretending that we can have four fully staffed emergency rooms and promising that her party, if it ever attains power, will do that. Well, her party was in power. They were the last government in power, and they came with a promise that they were going to maintain emergency rooms, and they immediately found they couldn't do it, and they switched wisely, I think, to promoting collaborative care centers instead, in place of places where it didn't make sense to maintain a 24-hour emergency service. And but she's now whipping up popular fervor, holding news conferences and public meetings and so forth to say, oh, yes, we can have four. All you have to do is elect new Democrats. Well, I suspect Industrial Cape Breton is going to elect some new Democrats in the next election. We'll just see how much success they have with that. It is not a practical solution. I think Martin knows that. Certainly her leader knows that. And I don't think anyone's communicating about this terribly well.
Okay, so to respond to a couple of things you said there. First, from the government side, one of the things the government has noted in its response to your concerns about how they're handling things is that they've started up a new health committee. In fact, that committee is meeting as we speak. Do you think that's a good enough response, that a lot of the concerns of the opposition are being heard on that committee, or is sort of... Do you see the same patterns reasserting themselves?
I think there's a similar pattern there, and healthcare is important enough that I guess it makes sense to have its own committee, but this gets to another matter. They promised before coming to power, and it's a promise they fulfilled, that they were going to consolidate the health boards into a single health board. I think the results of that were entirely predictable. As soon as some region of the province requests something and doesn't get it, there's going to be a natural resentment to decision makers in Halifax making decisions here. And I think that's been most clear in the allocation of where physicians can practice.
Do you think any of the misgivings about centralization are justified, or are you just saying it was a politically unwise thing?
Both. I think some of them have been unwise. It certainly, from some of the anecdotes you've heard about, for example, the doctor who was practicing in Antigonish and Inverness, who wanted to only practice in Inverness, and they told her she couldn't do that. Inverness does have a higher shortage of doctors than either Antigonish or Industrial Cape Breton. If there's any place in Cape Breton that suffers a modest shortage of doctors, it's Inverness. So I just have the feeling that both the perception that decisions are being made at a long distance, and in some cases, at least, the reality that decisions are making in both places. If we're going to only have one health board, then why do we need a Department of Health? If we're going to have health boards, it seems to me they ought to have a regional basis. So I don't buy that this was going to solve a lot of duplication. I think it was hugely expensive to undertake the consolidation, and then, you know, much as with school boards, we end up with the same kinds of officials carrying the same kinds of staff and the same kinds of salaries, except that they don't have the decision-making autonomy they used to have. The decisions are made in the central area. So
Now, there is some talk about maybe putting one of the VPs in Cape Breton and a few more executives for the health authority. Do you think that would be enough, what they're at least gesturing at?
Well, if I was czar of the province, I'd go back to a system with regional boards.
But wouldn't it be hard to undo that now, though?
Well, no harder than it was to do it. I think it was wrong-headed, and I think it was wrong-headed enough that it probably ought to be reversed. But I suppose having a VP located, but that doesn't solve the problem in Amherst. It doesn't solve the problem in Yarmouth. And if you're going to have VPs in all of those places, I think you can be sure that if someone's working in Halifax and they get assigned to be the VP in Cape Breton, they're probably going to think of it as like being assigned to Siberia. I don't know that it's going to... I think if you're going to have local authority to make decisions, you need local authority to make decisions. You don't need an official who reports to somebody in Halifax.
It's interesting to note that I don't think any of the parties have committed to reversing that consolidation of health authorities. I mean, might that be an indication that they just fear what a logistical nightmare it might be?
Maybe. I might be all wet on that. I honestly, I haven't given it a lot of thought. I have given a lot of thought to the reorganization plan, and I haven't heard anything from anyone else that has... I haven't heard a better plan. I certainly don't think the pie in the sky, oh, we can keep everything open and it'll be just fine, just vote for us and it'll be cool, is not a health plan.
Well, you mentioned the NDP. I think you're hinting at the NDP view there, and you noted that the former NDP government wasn't able to keep a lot of its promises in healthcare, but they would note that at that time, the Dexter government was dedicated to balancing the budget. Whether or not they do maybe has to do with one's accounting opinion, but regardless, clearly Burrell and company have adopted similar stance to the Trudeau Liberals in a way that they believe in deficit spending, at least at this point. So, I mean, they would argue that if they engaged in a moderate amount of deficit spending, that they would actually be able to meet the goals they're setting for themselves. I take it you don't believe that either.
I mean, it's to some extent, it's a question of how high is up. I suppose if they spend unlimited amounts of money, they can do almost anything, but they don't have unlimited amounts of money. And if they tried to borrow unlimited amounts of money, the province's credit rating would suffer.
So in other words, no reasonable amount of borrowing could help them meet their promises, is what you're claiming.
Yeah, I think we're exactly. I think we're maxed out. I think the province, we have probably the highest tax burden in Canada. We have the highest, we're at the highest HST rate. Does anyone, raise your hands? Everyone thinks the HST should be 20% or 25% or 30%. We have as high a marginal tax rate on our income tax as any other province, higher than most. We have a smaller, poorer, older population, so the financial resources of the citizens and companies from which we can potentially draw taxes is limited. And we have, between health and education, about two-thirds of our budget is gone right there. Then you have community services and transportation, big, big demands on the public purse. And then you have 40 other government activities, all of which have constituencies and are worthwhile things, but that constantly get squeezed. So it's a hard province to govern. We have people who expect a lot of services, and we have a very limited ability to pay for them. and if you're going to, if you're going to finance it, I just, why would you do that? Why would you borrow money from our children and grandchildren to keep 4 emergency rooms open. If all the things you could spend on, why would you do it to keep 4 emergency rooms open 24 hours a day, especially given the proven failure, inability to do that for the last 2 decades by 3 different political parties? It just, I understand the emotions that are being appealed to, but I think it's a cheap political trick.
So, I mean, I'm glad you brought up the emotion because it is an emotional issue. I mean, being from New Waterford, I know this firsthand. You know, I know there was a gentleman that spent most of his post-retirement life coming around to many doors, including mine, raising money for the hospital. People are really attached to it because miners in the community helped to build that. So if there are these emotions out there, how can they be addressed properly and justifiably by the government in terms of selling it? I mean, you've said more empathy.
That's the job of a politician. The job of a politician is to be able to sell people on difficult issues. If governing was easy, if you could simply whistle up money and throw it at every problem, governing would be easy. But it isn't. Governing is about choices. It's about making tough choices. It's about deciding to do this and not that. And that requires, I think, an openness to make your case and make it in a serious empathetic but realistic way.
So you think it's just a matter of an empathy deficit on Mr. McNeil's part or other cabinet ministers?
I think McNeil is very quick to go to the tough guy route. You saw this with the education debate during the teacher strike and so forth. He faced a very vociferous, very organized opposition there in the form of the teachers' union and teachers and their families who were extremely active on social media. And instead of letting his very capable health minister handle the issue and only stepping in at the very end, he was really quick to get involved and get involved with, you know, kind of almost taunting the other side. I believe the population of the province was strongly in his corner on that. And the fact that he got it reelected almost immediately after that happened, the first time two majority governments had been elected in a row since 1988, maybe, since John Buchanan anyway, a generation ago, I think he had the public well on his side, but he certainly didn't, you know, I think he may have prolonged the fight by being a little on the nasty side about that, and I see some of the same in this. He's not a warm, touchy-feely premier.
So if nasty worked for him then, why shouldn't he just keep doing it now?
Well, I don't think it worked for him then. I think he made the situation worse with being nasty there. I think he could have been firm and calmer, firm and taken the same positions, but without injecting himself personally into it, and without rhetorically being quite as hot as he was.
So I take it
He didn't screw around with the rules in the legislature start, you know, trying to avoid the debate. He should be welcoming the debate. He's got a good position to defend. He, and more particularly his health minister, who hasn't acquitted himself terribly well in this conversation, should be making the case. They should be being interviewed by you today rather than me.
Well, it's worth noting that I have interviewed Mr. DeLory on this.
Right. Okay. How do you do?
Well, I mean, as it's not for me to say, that's for listeners to decide, I suppose. But I mean, I will say I had an extensive conversation with him on this. He's been visible. I mean, well, but I mean, in terms of the way he's conducted himself, what specifically do you think he did wrong?
Oh, I just, as I see social media, as I read the Cape Breton Post and the Chronicle Herald, and I read a couple of the weeklies on the island as well. It just feels to me as though the debate is being carried entirely by, almost entirely by, people who say, oh, this is the worth, you know, it's they're selling our birthright and so on and so forth. Let's go to your fellow in Glace Bay who's been a dedicated volunteer supporting that hospital. That's a wonderful thing. And someone like that, understandably discouraged to see the hospital that he's devoted a lot of time and attention to will not continue in its present form. I think that man deserves to have someone who has been elected to make decisions speaking to him directly and explaining why they can't, why the sensible decision is to change the organization of our hospitals.
So do you agree with the opposition's request then that Mr. DeLory actually come here and meet with community groups, or do you think that's just a political gimmick, or maybe both?
Well, I mean, public meetings are problematic in that it's extremely easy, especially in an emotional debate, for you know, those meetings to deteriorate into catcalls and yells and go back to Halifax and, you know, all of that kind of crap that we're really good at in Cape Breton.
But it's a politician's job to take that, right?
Well, it's a politician's job to find a way to communicate. And it may not be that going and conducting public meetings where a determined, organized group of opposition will try to disrupt and take over the meeting. But I think they could be down here more often explaining what they're doing. I mean, for one thing, they could put some meat on the bones of the, right now all we have is a very, very high level look at what's going to happen. They I think have been rightly criticized by not consulting beforehand with doctors and other healthcare professionals, emergency room EMTs and nurses and paramedics. It would have been much better if there had been a more organized consultation with them.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Bobby Nock.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca.